7BR Part Heard.
Hello, and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. I'm Rhys Palmer, Chambers Paralegal. We're joined today by 7BR members Jim Rowbottom and the Right Honourable Sir John Goldring for the final segment of our inquest series. Jim has extensive experience representing interested persons at high-profile inquests and in subsequent civil claims, including for clinical negligence and claims under the Human Rights Act 1998. His inquest practice covers Article 2 inquests in relation to all forms of state detention, mental health care, general clinical care, deaths in care homes, road traffic accidents, and inquests arising from criminal conduct. He has particular expertise in relation to deaths arising in mental health care and is listed as a leading junior in the Inquest and Inquiry section of the Legal 500 and Chambers & Partners UK Bar Guide 2021. Sir John Goldring is currently the President of the Court of Appeal of the Cayman Islands. Prior to this appointment, he sat in various judicial capacities, including as a Section 9 judge, a judge of the Courts of Appeal of Jersey and Guernsey, the presiding judge of the Midland Circuit, and the senior presiding judge of England and Wales. He is the chair of the appeal panel for Lambeth Children's Home Redress Scheme and the Deputy Investigatory Powers Commissioner. Jim, Sir John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rhys.
So we're here today to wrap up our four-part inquest series where we've discussed the recently published book, Coroner's Investigations and Inquests, which, Jim, you've co-edited, and Sir John, you wrote the foreword to.
Yeah.
John, one key position which I didn't introduce in your introduction was where you sat as the coroner for the Hillsborough inquest into the 96 deaths of the Liverpool fans, probably one of the most well-known inquests to date. Now, the topic of today's podcast is legal reform in an inquest context. You were part of the Working Party of Justice that wrote a report on this exact topic. From your experience as a coroner, what were the key failings that you identified that led to you to participate in this report?
Obviously, my experience, Rhys, was rather limited in the sense that Hillsborough was an inquest unlike most others, I think it's fair to say. But if I just glance at the executive summary of the Justice report, it highlights a number of pretty large issues. I think looking at process, the lack of consistency in process, partly as a function of local authority control of inquests, I think, and Jim will have a much better idea than I do, I think when an inquest starts, families have a very high expectation of what it can achieve. And in the final analysis, what an inquest can achieve may be quite limited and may lead to families' disappointment. I think there is a great problem between different tribunals dealing with the same issues. So you have inquests, you may have a criminal prosecution, about which I'll say more in due course. You will have civil litigation. The consequence is you will have people, and particularly the families, being interviewed many times. You'll have processes which go on for a very long time. And I think anything that can be done to simplify it would be a good idea. I think as far as the actual inquests are concerned and the hearing, I think another element, which is in a sense follows because of the way that we approach inquests, is that they can become over-adversarial, and that is a real problem. It obviously follows because at the final analysis, someone's going to be blamed for what happened, and if people are being blamed, inevitably it leads to battles when they say, I'm not to blame. And Jim, no doubt, can speak as to the adversariality and the expectation of families particularly. I think there are issues as to whether or not there ought to be juries in inquests. I think there are issues as to what happens when an inquest has concluded and it makes recommendations. What happens to those recommendations? Often, I fear it may be very little. And all those are matters which we hoped in the Justice Report to deal with. And I can obviously cover some of them in some more detail if you want, in due course.
No, thank you. I think you've touched upon some of the points that I was wishing to ask you about that we'll address in a moment. But before we get there, Jim, I just wanted to know from your experience dealing with inquests now as a current practicing practitioner, Are these still some of the failings and shortcomings that you see today?
Yes, certainly. I predominantly represent families. And I think one of the most important things to consider about an inquest is it's not like other proceedings in the sense that it's not brought by anyone. An inquest happens to someone, and it could happen to any of us tomorrow. And if it happened to you, you would be thrown into a kind of arcane world where the law is complicated. The management of it can be complicated because, as Sir John mentioned, they are run by local authorities and coroners are funded by local authorities. So you get great variation between coroners and jurisdictions, or areas, I should say, regarding the way in which they're conducted. And yeah, I would second all the issues raised by John. I think particularly for me, two things. One, the legal aid issue, which I'm sure we'll touch upon. I know that the Justice Committee report made a specific recommendation in respect of making legal aid available. Yeah, I mean, that's felt acutely by families, because in complicated inquests, there can be many lawyers representing many different people, and you may not be eligible for state funding. The other thing that I think really stands out for me is how complicated it is. What you actually have with inquests, and this is partly dealt with in the book, is you have an ancient system with a modern overlay. There were some reforms in 2013 when the 2009 Coroners and Justice Act came into force. But then you have an additional overlay of the requirements of Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights. And between those things, especially in fact now with the lowering of the standard of proof for unlawful killing, you really do have a system that's at the beginning very hard to advise a family on in terms of what they can expect, how things will work out in a situation where, as I said, an inquest happens to you.
Jim, do you think families do have a very high expectation once they've landed in this situation, which in the end it's very hard to fulfill?
I think that depends on the coroner. It depends a lot on the family, and it depends a lot on what's happened. There's really a vast range of scenarios in which inquests can happen. Funding plays into that, and the format of the inquest plays into that. Because if an inquest is an Article 2 inquest, then you at least can advise a family that at the end there'll be a duty on the coroner to consider whether there's been any failings.
Yeah.
At the moment, the law's not clear that in an non-Article 2 case, the coroner should be looking at failings at all. So it then becomes a matter for the discretion of the individual coroner whether they're prepared to look at whether, for instance, a hospital did, there were failings in the care. I hesitate to use the language because, of course, you can't use the language of negligence because we're talking about inquests.
Well, that is one of the artificialities of it, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And there are the problems. You have to advise a family that there's a prohibition on blame. There's a statutory prohibition on using words that impart criminal or civil liability. But you're about to see lawyers fight over those things effectively over the next few months and so, or years. So I think the most important thing you can do as a representative is give families, as a family representative, is give families realistic advice on what you can do for them and what will happen. I always say, you know, we can ask the questions that you want asked within the boundaries the law sets, but because the proceedings are controlled by the coroner and because of the way the law works, we can't control the answers.
Yeah. Rhys, to pick up one of the points that you mentioned as to the failings, obviously the Hillsborough inquest, which I held, wasn't the first inquest that was held in relation to the disaster. And at the first inquest, the families were represented by a Silk and a Junior, full stop. The various interested persons were represented by many Silks, and there were many interested persons, and it wasn't balanced. And that's something obviously the families felt very strongly about. And I think it comes back to the point that Jim has just raised, and that is the question of funding. Because in the absence of funding, it is all becomes extremely difficult. I mean, there was proper funding for the families in the second Hillsborough inquests, but that is by no means general. And I think one of the recommendations we made, I was just trying to pick it up, actually, was that there should be an amendment of the exceptional funding guidance on inquests so as to provide for non-means-tested public funding for representation where the state has agreed to provide separate representation for one or more interested persons. And I think the funding is absolutely crucial in that, and the sense of fairness then, as far as the families are concerned, and as far as representation is concerned.
Going off of that, one of the other observations that I noticed from the report that stood out to me was the point on duty of candor and institutional defensiveness acting sort of as a barrier to accountability. What does this actually mean, and how does that play out really in reality?
We're now obviously talking about inquests in which there is possible state responsibility. And the process of an inquest, of course, is quite unlike any other proceedings in that it is a non-adversarial and inquisitorial system. So what it is in theory an open-ended inquiry as to what happened, and simplifying greatly, how the deaths or the death came about. That means that in principle, you don't need to have a case. You can simply ask questions. You can seek to lay blame in the questions you ask, but you don't have to commit yourself to putting forward any specific case. And what the duty of candor requires is that where the state is said to have a responsibility, it should have a concomitant duty, frankly, to say in open court, in the front of everybody, what its position is. It's under the broad heading, I'm looking at the recommendations as summarized, so that a statutory duty of candor subject to the privilege against self-incrimination. So if your interested person bears some responsibility on the evidence that you have, and you know that is the case, you have a duty to say so. And not simply just to ask a lot of open-ended questions, hoping to wriggle out of your responsibility. And that, in short, is what the duty of candor requires of you. And with it goes the possibility of the coroner saying to the parties or the interested persons, you see, I'm slipping into language which is not appropriate for inquests, parties. The coroner can ask the interested persons in writing to say what their case is. So it is then they are setting out a case, and of course, with a duty of candor, it will be their candid, their frank case. So if their case is that somebody failed to do something, that's what their case will say, and that's what the duty will require. It will require legislation, I anticipate, to have such a duty. And obviously, as I've said, there is a privilege against self-incrimination. But if that applies, it could lessen the adversariality of the process. I don't know what you think about it, Jim. It obviously applies in situations where representatives of the state, whether it's a hospital or whatever it is said to have some responsibility as far as the death is concerned.
I think it's a wonderful idea. Whether there is a great prospect of it being legislated for, I guess, is a different matter. But I think
it's a very different matter.
Yes, but it's worth thinking through what the benefit, because the benefits for the whole system would be enormous, not, you know, yes, for families, but also, I mean, a prison inquest can last weeks. Typically, a prison suicide inquest, of course, there are hundreds of those each year, sadly. One of the things about an inquest is no one, as you point out, Sir John, is under an obligation to put forward a position. Some coroners ask for agreed facts, but because you can't agree in an inquest a judgment, as it were, you don't ever get persons putting forward their positions. And I think that would be revolutionary from an inquest perspective, because there is something about inquests and the procedure that inevitably ends up with them becoming adversarial by their nature, that you have, you know, six, seven, however many groups of lawyers around an investigation into one issue, and some certainty and some forethought from the persons into what they were saying. And so organizations having to confront whether there were systemic or individual failings in what happened, say, for instance, if certain observations hadn't been done on a mental health patient, or if there were systemic issues in a prison with regard to training and the ACT system, the system that's designed to prevent suicide in prisons.
Yeah.
If persons had to think about that beforehand, then it could potentially cut weeks off inquests and stop heartache and difficult evidence having to be heard in any event.
I mean, it's well put, actually, in the executive summary. As it says, institutional defensiveness can impede the effectiveness of an inquiry. This also applies to a public inquiry or inquest, with a detrimental impact on participation and public confidence. And that is then, it sets out the requirement for a duty of candor with a rebuttable requirement for position statements, which would help, as it puts it, to foster a cards on the table approach. Of course, the implications are very, very broad. Because if in the course of an inquest you accept some form of responsibility, it isn't what your insurers may want you to do in the almost inevitable civil litigation which will follow. So that's why it has to be dealt with, I think, by statute.
Yes, but that's a fascinating point in itself, because one of the great unsaid things about inquests, I think, is the relationship between civil proceedings and inquests and how those things play out practically. It plays out in funding as well, because as lawyers know, one of the ways in which representation can be provided for a family to an inquest is on the basis of a CFA, for instance, if there's a clinical negligence claim following it. And so that all becomes part of the process of an inquest tangentially, which doesn't help families, in my view. Legal aid should be available so that families didn't necessarily feel they had to sue someone off the back of it, and you might save some money in that way. You might also save some money and some of the pressure on the civil litigation system if interested persons had to really consider whether they were also civilly liable up front. So from an inquest perspective and from a family inquest perspective, I think it'd be a wonderful thing. But as you say, we do need to think about how it would impact upon other areas of law.
There was a draft bill, in fact. It was drafted by one of the leaders in the Hillsborough inquests. But whether it will ever see the light of day as an Act of Parliament, we shall have to see.
Mm. You both mentioned sort of the adversarial nature, or the inadvertent adversarial nature that can arise, and the lengthy process that this can take. And then, Jim, you were just mentioning there that off of this, there's sometimes civil litigation that can follow. One of the shortcomings that the Justice Report identified was that of the duplication between public inquiries and inquests, and the overlapping of processes. Is this an issue that can be resolved, or is this something that is just an inevitable reality of the way that inquests, inquiries, and other forms of litigation work?
I think it's a very good question, Rhys. Is it insoluble? I think it can be mitigated. Whether it's soluble is another matter. One of the ways that we sought to mitigate it to some degree was the special procedure inquests and the relationship between public inquiries and inquests. And I think it's easier to see the public inquiry inquest relationship having a means of avoiding duplication. I think it's harder in the context of criminal prosecutions, possible criminal prosecutions, and civil litigation. And I think in the end, we suggested that as much effort should be made so that there is as little duplication, even if it's on from the point of view of getting witness statements from people by many different, in this case, it might be parties. But it is a real problem. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, in the Hillsborough inquests, the criminal proceedings, which as we speak, of course, are not concluded, followed the inquests. But that was exceptional. It's normally, obviously, the other way around. I think it can be mitigated, and we make a number of suggestions as to how, but I don't think it can be entirely obviated. Again, I don't know what you think about that, Jim.
Yeah, it is difficult. I think that in terms of inquests and other proceedings, I think criminal proceedings sit on their own and have to happen on their own because they happen for different reasons in relation to the state. I think solving the relationship or doing anything about the relationship between inquests and civil proceedings would have to, you'd need root and branch reform of the inquest system. And that didn't happen in 2013.
No, the government was not keen. At least the minister, who was then Lord Chancellor and Minister of Justice, was not keen. I happen to know that.
I always think one of the things about inquests is it's difficult to know quite what they're for. You have the archaic system that's there to determine the four statutory questions. You have the modern Regulation 28, Prevention of Future Deaths part, which is forward-looking to prevent future deaths. And then you have the overlay of the requirements of Article 2. But it's between those things, there isn't one purpose. I think the special procedure inquest that put forward in the report are a superb idea, because the suggestion, amongst other things, is that there would be thematic inquests into systemic issues now. That made me think, I mean, obviously one of the biggest traditional issues in inquests in England and Wales is prison suicides.
Yes.
But in my experience, it's overwhelmingly common to turn up to a prison inquest and a coroner to tell you, well, we can't look at any other deaths at this prison in the last 20 years. And, you know, you say, well, the prison and probation ombudsman looked at the death that occurred a year ago that had very similar failings, and you'll be told, but it's inadmissible. We can't look at that now. If you actually go back to Sacca in the House of Lords in 2004 or 6, Lord Bingham gives a long speech saying these are the problems with suicide in the system. And if the system is there to prevent suicide, then if a prison has several suicides in a row over a period of years, I struggle to understand how that's not relevant if the purpose of the system is to prevent prison suicides. And I think that, you know, you get similar issues in healthcare inquests. And I think that the special procedure, I mean, again, whether it's going to be taken up in legislation is a different issue, but I think it's a superb idea for those reasons.
Well, that was one of, I mean, obviously the objective of an inquest is to prevent future deaths occurring in some similar way. And if one excludes in an inquest those similar deaths and simply concentrates as though it's an isolated case that you're dealing with, you simply don't achieve that. And it seems to me completely absurd, if I may say so, that we look at these things in complete isolation. And of course, it is one of the things, I think, that in some ways, families, I was going to say find helpful, I'm not quite sure that's the right word, but I think if families felt that the inquest that's being held would actually help prevent future similar deaths, that is helpful to them. And I think we're very bad at looking at it in that way. And I think we're very bad, even if there has been a more systemic consideration, for example, in a very major inquest or obviously in a public inquiry, we are very bad at then following up whether anything has actually happened. And that's one of the big changes that we were suggesting. It seems to me much of the rationale is lost, or part of the rationale is lost, if one doesn't follow up as to whether changes have come about as a result of what was recommended.
Obviously, the prevention of future deaths is a crucial part of the modern inquest, but it's still only recognised in secondary legislation compared with the Section 5 duties. But I think in the recent case in Mourne, Lady Arden emphasised really the importance of preventing deaths and particular suicides in a mental health context and in prisons. And so I'm hopeful that we are moving towards that being seen as, if not one of the purposes, perhaps the predominant purpose.
Yes, I mean, it even doesn't happen in public inquiries. I mean, I'm just looking at what is said in the executive summary under the broad heading of effecting change. and it underlines how patchy is the effecting of change, and it underlines the importance to the bereaved people and the survivors of effective change. But again, that's, well, one can only express the hope that those parts also change.
Yeah, I agree.
We've spoken about this from sort of a top-down approach. How can individual practitioners from the ground up help to rectify these shortcomings and failures?
I think that's directed at you, in fact, Jim. I mean, my only observation is successfully persuade the coroner to do it properly.
Yeah, I mean, you've got an issue, as Sir John points out, in the first place, because it's the coroner's inquest. I think there's no obligation on you to do so, but I think if advocates can work together with the broader purposes of the inquest in mind, if advocates representing state bodies are mindful of the principles that govern representing state bodies, broadly speaking, and if family advocates bear in mind, you know, expectations and their clients, then sometimes you can get through it. But sometimes, through no fault of anyone's, you can't. And there does need to be systemic change if that's going to happen. I think there's a limited amount individual advocates and representatives can do.
I was just going to ask one question, if I may, of Jim. And that is, do you think it is appropriate still to have juries in inquests? Obviously not generally, but in Article 2 inquests?
Yes, I think, yeah, I do actually. I do in prison deaths. I do in wider public interest cases where perhaps there's unlawful killing potential with the police or different state bodies involved. I think strongly that in some inquests, particularly clinical ones, that it can get overly complicated. I think the problems with juries are, in actual fact, in the way the interplay between the law, how complicated the law gets at the end of an Article 2 inquest, and then the restrictions to the coroner in leaving them conclusions, which I don't need to tell you about, I wouldn't imagine.
But it's done in writing, and it can be simplified, and if it's all done in writing, as should happen in serious criminal cases.
Yeah, but I do think juries should stay. Whether they should stay for every case, I'm not sure, but they provide a crucial element of public scrutiny, I think.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Sorry, Rhys, I interrupted what was going to be your next point.
I was simply just going to ask these points and the discussions that we've been having. These are, Jim, aren't they, in the book that you've just written, and our listeners will be able to find some sort of help and guidance from that.
Yes. I mean, they're in it to a limited extent. We weren't asked by LexisNexis to write a treatise on inquest reform, much as I would have been really chuffed to do so. But there are, I mean, in particular, I think Richard Baker and Linda Reynolds spoke at one of the other podcasts, two podcasts ago, about representing families. There's a really, really great chapter written by them on representing families. We've tried to, you know, cover representing different organisations and in different kinds of inquests. So there's a lot about, there's a particular chapter that I wrote with Rose Harvey Sullivan about mental health and capacity. So they are covered, but no, it's not like the philosophy inquest. No, it's more there to help practitioners and potentially families, hopefully, navigate their way through the system.
And also, as I read the book, also to help those who give evidence who are neither families nor practitioners, but maybe expert witnesses or whatever.
Yes, that's completely right. And we tried to make it as broad as possible in terms of the different parties that might be there and the different tangential proceedings that might be relevant. Yeah. So yeah.
Well, Jim, Sir John, thank you for joining me today to round up our inquest series. It's been a pleasure having both of you on today.
Thank you very much, Rhys.
Thanks for having us, Rhys.
Thank you to our listeners. We hope you enjoyed today's episode of 7BR's Part Heard. If you missed this series, you can find the previous episodes from 7BR members Rose Harvey Sullivan, Richard Baker, and James Weston, where they discuss various topics within the scope of an inquest. Don't forget that their book, Coroner's Investigations and Inquests, which was co-authored by members of 7BR and leading inquest solicitors, is available in hard copy and digital form from LexisNexis. A link will be provided alongside this week's episode on Chamber's website. Join us next week, where we are joined by Joshua Yetman to discuss strikeouts in the Employment Tribunal and his recent appearance in Employment Appeals Tribunal. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.